Today on Peace Talks Radio, a look at maybe the oldest conflict scenario in human history, sibling rivalry.
And I do remember feeling some kind of way about my brother not liking me. I just felt like he just did not like me.
Being constantly told by your sibling, you're fat, you're ugly, things like this, can have lifelong effects.
We try to understand why it can be so intense during childhood and what parents can do to reduce sibling conflict.
The most valuable commodity to a child is mother's love and attention. They're very aware from the beginning. And so a wise parent will make sure that she and he could do anything possible to increase the status of the older sibling.
Also, how to mend those fractured sibling relationships that last into adulthood.
Can we try to have a relationship as adults? I really want to do it. Tell me what I need to do.
Tell me?
Yes.
Wow.
How do you like that?
Yeah, and did you actually do it?
Our panel on sibling rivalry today on Peace Talks Radio. This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, along with Suzanne Kreider. And this time, the conflict scenario that we're going to look into with our guests is sibling rivalry, something that seems ubiquitous across cultures and is as old as the oldest stories in human history.
It's so powerful and so common that it's in the first chapter of the Bible.
Samuel Roll is a psychologist and professor emeritus in psychology at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, talking to Suzanne Kreider.
Cain and Abel, certainly the first homicide, the first fratricide was between the two first brothers. And also Isaac and Esau. Isaac stole his brother's birthright, cheated Esau out of his birthright. And then Jacob's children then went ahead and sold their youngest brother to Egyptians to be a slave. That's how the Jews got into Egypt, all through sibling rivalry.
Rivalry in siblings is built in biologically. It happens in bacteria. It happens in plants, truly.
Jeannie Safer is a New York psychologist and author.
It was fascinating to discover this. When I wrote my book, Cain's Legacy, I talked to an evolutionary biologist, and he told me, among other things, about a rosewood tree in India. I'll never forget its name. It's called Dalbergia sisu. And what it does is the first seed that develops in the pod on the plant, the furthest from the trunk, exudes a poison that kills all the other seeds. So this is the basis of the bad seed. It kills all the other seeds, so it could be the only next rosewood tree. And this is something that happens all through the animal kingdom, and it happens in every nursery of humans.
Atlanta authors and parents Deneen Milner and Nick Childs know all about this. They have two teenage daughters.
They were fighting this morning. My girls do tend to do a lot of hitting and kicking, and it is meant to be playful, but you can kind of see that they're not really kidding.
The competition is going to be enormous, whether it's competing for the parents' affections, practically everything that they do, academics, athletics, video games. You know, who has a better accent when they're imitating some other country's accent? I mean, just everything you can imagine they squabble over. And so there's a lot of ground there for conflict.
Dr. Jeannie Safer, I'm going to give you four conflict scenarios. I want you to pick the worst.
I bet that won't be difficult. Well, they're probably all awful.
In terms of sibling rivalry, I think of like when siblings are young, they fight, and also when siblings are older, adults, they fight. That's two. Mm-hmm. Now, with parents, they could be having young siblings, or they can have adult siblings. So of those four conflict scenarios, which one do you think is the worst?
I think adult siblings, when they have their full functionality as adults, can get into the most vicious conflicts because they say things to each other. This actually happened. One sibling said to the other, "You never thanked me for the flowers I bought you in 1982. And this was 2002. So I think, in a sense, that because it shows the bitterness over time and the fact that these issues are so entrenched, that is worse than getting hit over the head by your brother, unless, of course, he abused you, which is a different thing. And adults also reinforce this notion. Many people in older life say that the thing that they regret most in their lives are the conflicts that they're having with their adult siblings. And the reason for that is that they're the last family members you have standing.
Yeah, but don't older siblings learn to be vicious when they're kids?
Yes. Yes, they do, absolutely. And the parents have a lot to do with that. But you're asking me in terms of which scenario was the most painful? It's the one that lasts.
So when I was a kid, I was the fourth of five. It was boy-girl, boy-me, boy. And I remember lots of competition as kids. We would compete for everything, even who was sitting in the front seat.
That sounds normal.
It drove my mom nuts. So what are a couple other scenarios of siblings conflicting?
Oh, what you just told me sounds like everyday stuff. The kinds of things that I'm talking about are a friend of mine who grew up to be a therapist whose brother tried to set her on fire. And the parents dealt with it by making sure there were no matches in the house. There we have the story of a lifelong thing. Or also the kind of silent things where one child, here's a subtle one, where one child gets a lot more attention and devotion from the parent and the other one secretly suffers until at the parent's funeral, when one is 60 and one is 68, the one who didn't get the attention said, "When I went through the house, I found a cigar box full of stuff of mine and an entire closet of yours." So that's a different kind of abuse or problems. These things can be quite disturbing to people. There's a lot of research that shows that even being constantly told by your sibling, "You're fat, you're ugly, you're not allowed to go to the bathroom unless I let you," things like this, can have lifelong effects.
Jeannie Safer with Suzanne Kreider. Suzanne unearthed this statistic for today's show. Approximately one-third of adults describe their relationship with their siblings as rivalrous or distant. Also, there's this. A 2005 study put the number of assaults each year to children by a sibling at about 35 per 100 kids. So about a third of children are actually suffering physical violence at the hands of siblings. So, although the Smothers Brothers joked about "Mom always liked you best," and most sitcoms over the years have made sibling rivalry into an ongoing joke, it can lead to serious emotional and physical hurt. Right now, more of Suzanne Kreider's talk with psychologist Samuel Roll in his Albuquerque office.
So, there are tips for the parents,
yes,
as well as for the kids. Let's start with parents. What tips would you give to parents?
Let's go back to the Bible. Why did Cain kill Abel? Cain killed Abel because both of them offered the best that they had to God. And God said to Abel, "I like yours better." Now, either God did not take Psychology 101,
oops,
or he had taken Psychology 101, but was trying to teach us a lesson, or our ancestors were trying to teach us a lesson. God showed a preference for one over the other. Why did Joseph's 11 brothers try to kill him? They try to kill him because their father, Jacob, had shown a preference for Joseph and given him the coat of many colors. Now, Jacob was a rich man with many cattle. Why didn't he give him all coats of many colors, or don't give any coat of many colors? By showing a preference and only giving Jacob the coat of many colors, they sealed his fate. Either all kids get a coat or no kids get a coat. So that's the first message for parents, is to be highly aware that children measure even the tiniest bit of Pepsi-Cola.
At what age?
They start at the very beginning. Of course, the most valuable commodity to a child is mother's love and attention. And so they're very aware from the beginning. And so a wise parent will make sure that she and he could do anything possible to increase the status of the older sibling. So if everybody's bringing gifts for the new baby, you make sure you get a gift for the big brother or the big sister and say, "You're such a good brother and such a good sister, I got something special for you." And it doesn't have to be just in terms of monetary things or physical things. They're just the easiest to use as metaphors, but also with time. And so if you have a child, you have a four-year-old child, and suddenly there's a new sister, a new brother, that brother or sister is going to be aware that the new sibling is taking a lot of mom's time. So one of the things you do as a mom, one of the things you do as a dad is say, listen, while the baby is sleeping, dad will stay here and you and I will go alone and get some special treats at the ice cream place. So you do the opposite of what God did in Genesis. You don't say, I like yours better. You say, you know what, I love you. And I'm going to show my love to you in a non-comparative way.
Deneen Milner, I read this book that said, it had a survey, and the survey said, if the most important person in your life, let's say your partner, came to you and said, I love you so much, I want one just like you, how would you feel and what would you do? Well, I think sometimes that's what people say to the first child.
That conversation happened around the second daughter, because our first daughter was just the sweetest, most amazing little baby. And when we decided to have a second child, I wanted another little girl just like the first one. And then the second one was born, and it was like a knock, you know, in the gut. There is no way that this child is ever going to be exactly like the first one. She came here, honestly, completely the opposite of the first. And they're both great girls, but their personalities, there's something to the idea of nature over nurture. They just came here as two completely different people.
Deneen, did the older girl get mad when the young girl was born?
Oh, no, not at all. She really enjoyed her little baby sister. And I remember having her take a sibling class so that she would work through her feelings on there being another human being who was getting her mom and dad's attention. And she really, you know, got excited about having her I'm the Big Sister t-shirt. I think that we were, just like most parents, really cognizant of making sure that she understood that our hearts were not going to be divvied up between the two of them, that our hearts would expand and, you know, be able to accommodate more than one person. Making sure that Mari understood that there was some respectability that we expected of her in dealing with her baby sister. And we got that for quite a few years. Now, I don't know about today, but...
when the younger sister started talking, it was all bets were
right,
off.
Right, exactly.
Well, Nick, I'm curious, how big can hearts expand? Like, how big can a family get?
I don't think that there's any limit to it. I think that, I mean, certainly our ancestors customarily had big families, and so I'm sure that they could speak to this pretty expertly. But as a parent of three, it doesn't feel to me like there's any limit to it, that your heart will expand exponentially as big as it needs to be to hold, to fit all of the little people in your life. I think it changes the way that you relate to the world, and it takes you outside of yourself. That's a human tendency to become self-centered, to kind of gaze at our navels and, oh, woe is me. And if you have a lot of little people running around your house, you're not allowed that luxury to dwell on, you know, inside your head for too long.
Deneen Milner, let's say these children, young children, are fighting or competing or hogging or teasing. What tips for parents would you give to make peace between those children?
Well, I think that it's important that the parents actually acknowledge that this is going on and talk to them about it. That's first and foremost. I mean, I am a little sister. You know, my brother and I have not gotten along at all, as far as I can remember. And it's only now that I'm pushing my late 40s and he's in his late 40s, about to be 50, that we actually can have a civil conversation without the snark and the attitude that used to come with our dealings with one another and simple conversations. And I do remember feeling some kind of way about my brother not liking me. I just felt like he just did not like me when I was little. And when I was in through high school and college, I didn't feel like my parents really ever addressed it. There was no conversation about how we just did not get along. I do remember one time us having a huge blow-up fight. It happened in front of both of our parents, and then I decided that I just wasn't going to talk to him anymore. I was tired. I'm grown. I have no reason to talk to him anymore. And so it would have been helpful leading up to, you know, that moment when I just decided I'm not going to talk to him anymore, if my parents understood everything that went into the dynamics of our relationship and actually gave their sort of grown-up opinions on how we could try to fix it, or at least have the conversation about the need for respect, or have us sort of sit down and sort of mediate between the two of us as the grown-ups in the room, as the parents in the room, to have that conversation extend outside of, you know, when we're gone, that's the only thing that you're going to have. You're only going to have each other, and so you better learn how to get along. Well, it's one thing to say we better learn how to get along. It's a whole nother thing to give us ways that we can get along. And so I think with our daughters, the conversation is a huge start, for me at least, because it was a conversation that my parents didn't have with me and my brother. And so our conversation usually sounds a little bit like, hey, here was the dynamic of my relationship with my brother. Here are the reasons why I had a problem with him. Here are the reasons why he had a problem with me. And you two need to sit down and discuss this and understand that you're not the same people. You have different ways of thinking about things, but neither of you are more right or more wrong than the other. And when you sit down and you talk about it and really understand the importance of your very unique relationship, you'll understand that what it is that you're fighting about right now is really kind of silly. And so for me, it's having the conversation.
Nick Charles, how about guidelines? Like, I'm curious, like, if you guys have family meetings or have certain rules, like, hey, no sarcasm, no name calling.
Yeah, I mean, these aren't things that have been written down. We don't have, like, commandments on the wall or anything like that. But we do a lot of things together. So one of the things that we insist on is interaction, conversation. And so we are very keen on our girls being articulate and expressive, not being those teenagers who are allowed to get away with the sullen mumbles and kind of pretending that they're the only people in the world. So we want them to be able to explain themselves, to express themselves when people ask them questions, to be able to articulate their answers clearly. So it might be, as we're leaving a movie, for each person to talk about why they liked the movie or why they didn't, which character was their favorite. There was a movie that we just saw that was actually really interesting in terms of all these dynamics, called Inside Out. It's a fascinating exploration of the inside of an 11-year-old girl's brain and all of the emotions that battle each other. And so it was a good opportunity for the family to talk about a lot of these issues and who's controlled by which emotions most often. You know, if mom is joy and anger and dad is sadness. And so that was a good opportunity or a good example of us having kind of this family conversation. But it's something that we do all the time. So in terms of rules, I mean, we strongly discourage physical contact. When they have disagreements, we want them to try to talk them out instead of yelling and shouting and hitting. Good luck with that. I think that we try to bring some empathy into the picture, particularly with the older daughter. The younger daughter is very naturally empathetic. I mean, she's almost to painfully so. It's easy for her to kind of put herself in the shoes of other people. Her older sister, not as much. And so we're often trying to get her to see things from the perspective of her younger sister. You know, the younger sister loves you. She respects you. She admires you. She wants to be around you. She wants to be in your presence. She wants you to like her. And so is that a crime? Is that something that she should be beat up over or ridiculed for? We don't think so. And so we want you to be cognizant of that. when you respond to her and when you overwhelm her with your sarcasm and you respond to everything, all of her observations with this kind of biting sarcasm or that seems intended to kind of cut her down. As an older sibling, she needs to be aware of how powerful her words can be. And so these are the kind of things that we're constantly trying to talk about with her. So the rules are for you to try to put yourself in the other person's position and to try to understand empathy or where the other person is coming from. And so that's something that we push hard with them.
That's Nick Childs and Deneen Milner, authors, journalists, and parents in Atlanta, Georgia. More from them and all of our guests as we explore sibling rivalry on this edition of Peace Talks Radio, which continues right after this break. You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution, online at peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls with Suzanne Kreider, who's asking the questions of our guests today about sibling rivalry, how to reduce it, or at least manage it. All of our panel members today have been saying, in effect, that once a second child comes into the picture of a family, there's really no getting around the experience of some degree of sibling rivalry stress, as parents or as a sibling yourself. In childhood and into adulthood as well, which is the focus of New York psychologist Jeannie Safer's practice and writing.
Do you have other ideas of what older siblings should do to make peace?
Yes. I believe that it is often possible, but not always possible. If you decide that you want to try to do it, and I can also talk about how you decide whether it's worth it, particularly in a serious estrangement, a bitter estrangement of years. But let's say you decide you want to try to do it. The first thing I recommend that people do is to think about their childhood and think about it through their siblings' eyes. That you want to first try to understand, what family did this person grow up in? I know we had the same biological parents. I know we had dinner together every night, but we have different relationships with our parents. What was his? What was hers? And then I want to ask myself, who is my sibling now? What is he as a brother? What is he as a father? What is he as a friend? What is he in all the relationships in his life unrelated to me? And the reason for that is that then you can get a sense of who this person is, leaving you out of it and leaving all the struggles and conflicts of childhood out of it. So you can get a feeling about that person. So once you do that, and once you do have memories and positive feelings that you think you want to try to express and have grow, then I always recommend taking the first step, which is to go to that person, in person if possible, second best is letter, 99th best is email. 150th best is text. I hate those forms of trying to make contact with a person. Is to go and say, look, we've had problems. You know, we've been rivals. There have been all kinds of issues between the two of us. But now we're adults. And you can say, now our parents are gone, or now our parents are ill and we need to work together, whatever it is. To say, can we try to have a relationship as adults? I really want to do it. Tell me what I need to do.
Tell me.
Yes.
Wow.
What do I need to do? How do you like that?
Yeah, and did you actually do it?
You actually present yourself to say, what's your view on this? And usually what you're greeted with is astonishment.
Yes.
And by the way, this is not a 15-minute conversation. if you have a sibling who's willing to make the effort, you've got probably a long time ahead of you to try to work it out. With backsliding, too.
Backsliding.
Yes. These relationships are not just fixed.
Okay.
And we should know that, because you shouldn't give up if it's not totally fixed. Try again.
Yeah.
And you can see, if the person makes an effort, it really makes a difference. And realize it's going to take time. It's not going to be simple. And it's going to be difficult. I want to emphasize that resolution of a long-standing sibling problem takes two. Although it takes two to have an actual relationship in your life, but it only takes you understanding that relationship within yourself to make a difference in your inner relationship with the sibling. And you can do this even if the sibling is dead, because I did. It was a very interesting thing when, at the age of 50, I went out to dinner with my mother and my brother, and my brother, who had many problems, was sitting there angry and sullen and silent. And for the first time in my life, I turned to him and I said, "I can't stand this silence. I'm here to have a conversation. If you don't want to have it, please don't stay." And my mother looked at me as though I had tried to kill her.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what?
What did he do?
He started talking a little bit. I wish I would have done it when I was 5 rather than 50, but I didn't know. So this is a very common scenario.
Dr. Safer, let's talk about disabled siblings. Because sometimes the able-bodied sibling feels like the caregiver or the ignored person. Do you have any recommendations for people who have disabled siblings?
Yes, yes. This is one of my specialties. I have really my entire practice pretty much is the healthy and fully abled siblings of the disabled in one way or another. These people are really put upon. The parents just kind of assume they're going to take over and take care of the other one. Very often, their lives have been quite damaged by the focus on the disability. And I'm not saying that disability shouldn't be dealt with, but they're afraid to bring people home. They're always given pep talks that this will make them better people. They don't get their parents' attention. There are a lot of issues there. And I have seen, I'll give you one example that's the most moving I've ever seen. A woman came to me who was in the field, and she had a brother who had been the terror of her childhood. He was a huge guy. He had epilepsy and also a number of other problems, and then became drug addicted. And she's a tiny thing. And the parents would leave them alone, and he would beat her up, or he would try to kill himself. She saved his life a number of times. And she was very estranged from him, and it was horrible. And then the parents started acting badly to her. Guess who came to her rescue? And they now have a wonderful relationship. It took a long time. It took a lot of work. He grew up. She helped him. She encouraged him. They found that they really had a lot of love and for each other. And it is the only time in many years of doing work with siblings that I ever saw a turnaround this great. But it means that it can happen if both people work at it.
Okay. I'm curious about siblings who have a different affectional orientation. We call them homosexuals. So do you have any recommendations about what to do if you have a homosexual sibling?
It is the responsibility in that case of the person who is not gay to work on accepting the one who is. And the one who is gay needs to recognize that, for instance, from a religious background, that it's going to be tough for your sibling, just like it could be tough for your parents. Now, hopefully, the sibling won't do what I have had several parents do with gay people when they came out. The mother or the father would say, "I wish you were dead," or "I wish you'd never been born." Now, this is not an excellent way to make a relationship with somebody.
Yes.
Try to listen. You know, if there's any advice I can give in sibling relationships after you're able to listen, let's say, you know, after adolescence, is listen to the other person. Ask how the other person sees you. How did they see your childhood? You know, what do they have to offer in their life? If your brother or sister is coming out, think about how you feel about it. And if you don't like it, it's not your business to tell them any more than it is if your brother or sister has a different political opinion than you.
Hmm. Okay.
There's a lot of fundamental differences that we have. They may have different child-rearing ideas. You know, lecturing them ain't going to do it. One of the things in love, in family love, is accepting someone who's different. You know, G.K. Chesterton said, and I quoted it in, I believe it was in Caine's Legacy, that families were created to help us learn to get along with people with whom we have nothing in common.
That's good.
And it's often true. But the fact is that people with whom we have nothing in common or not fundamental things in common can turn out to be wonderful.
Yeah.
And we have to work at it. In sibling relationships, the work always starts in yourself. And then you try to work with your sibling. That is really what I feel is important.
So I see in siblings that emotions are constantly shifting.
That's right.
Like with my brother. I had an older brother who I didn't really like. And sometimes I really hated him. But one day, there was a bully when I was in kindergarten, probably 5 years old. This bully wouldn't let me pass on the sidewalk.
Wow.
I told my mom, and I can't remember, but I think my brother said, I'll take care of it. He was 7. I was 5.
Really?
Yes. And so he took care of it. And I think what he did was he saw the bully walking in front of me, and he went up to the bully. I don't think he hit him. I think he talked to the bully, because the bully never stopped me again. He never got in my way again. He never bothered me again.
Can I have your brother?
So I felt really grateful to him.
That's so wonderful.
So it was like, I hated him, then I was grateful.
That's so, you know, something must have been going on that was right, that he could do that. He had empathy, and he wanted to show his strength and be protective. What a marvelous story. Did that change your relationship with him?
Short term. Yeah, short term it did.
but not totally, right? Because hostility is built in. So, but it gave you something that you remember now, which I assume is a few years later.
Yes.
And are you close now at all?
Somewhat. But I'm curious if there are other roles that we look at siblings. It's like competing, hating, loving, gratitude. What are some other roles that people go through, or some other, you know, pluses of having a sibling?
Oh, there are wonderful things about having a sibling. I have never experienced them, but I've seen them, and I envy and appreciate them. A sibling is someone who, when you really have a close relationship, is really always there for you. I remember once when my first book about siblings came out. It's called The Normal One. It's about siblings who are really problematic, who have mental or physical illnesses. And I was talking to someone in a little coffee house around the corner, and she said, oh, my brother's sitting over there. He runs a bookstore. I have to tell him about this. And she ran over to her brother. She gave him a kiss, and she said, look, I just heard about this book. You know, and they were talking about it together, and I thought, this is an experience I've never had, and how precious this is. How precious. I have a friend who got Parkinson's disease, and her sister has been her bulwark. In fact, she had her ill sister come to stay with her for 2 weeks and got a whole medical workup at a world-famous clinic for her. And I thought, this is really something. So it can be a special kind of friendship. Mm. Remember that a sibling is the only person who remembers your childhood. They may remember it differently than you do, and I almost guarantee that they will. But they carry your memories.
Do. Yeah.
And if you can somehow tap into that, by the way, if you and your brother, as an example, were having problems now, what I would recommend as a way to work on them, I'm not saying you are, but if you ever did, is to go to him and say, I will never forget when you were my champion when you were 7. Hmm. I will never forget it. And if you have memories like that, it can weather a lot of storms in adult life.
That's a great idea.
In adult siblings, I get calls all the time from people who are saying, I don't talk to my brother. We have to deal with my mother's aging. What do we do? Or I want to try to make some rapprochement. How do I do it? And very often what I suggest is that the person who is interested in making that rapprochement talk to a therapist and then to see whether the sibling or siblings are also willing to do that. I don't ever see everybody together at first because I want to get each side of it or each 50 sides of it, whatever number of people. And then I get a sense of what might be going on and I try to suggest some things to them that might help. And then if they're both willing, I see them together. One of these I did by mail, which was by email. I did it by email because it was a woman that I knew very well who also was a radio host and also very sophisticated psychologically. And she had a younger sister that, this is in Kane's Legacy, you probably read about her, she was just very estranged with her, and she felt awful about how she had treated her because she hated the sister, and she figured out why, and she desperately wanted to make amends. So what did she do? She wrote a long, psychologically sophisticated letter to her sister about what she did and how she felt, and it was terrible experiences that made her do this. Guess what the sister did?
What?
Nothing.
Yeah.
The sister didn't answer. She was devastated. She said, oh my God, I wrote this whole thing and my sister didn't even answer. And I said, how about sending me the letter? So she sent me the letter. And guess what? The letter was all about her.
Mm-hmm.
I did this and I did that and I'm so sorry. Nothing about how the sister might feel. So I said, let's edit this letter. Let's write a new letter, which is about your sister, not about you.
Mm-hmm.
And she did this several times. We had it was a kind of editing session over email for a few months, and she would tell me how her sister would respond or not respond. And then one time, after this all happened, they were at a Christmas, family Christmas, which is where we see our adult estranged siblings at these holiday events, which everybody dreads, who's estranged.
Yeah.
And these are terrible events for a lot of people. And so she went to her sister, you know, desperate for a sign. And she said, well, how did you feel about my letter? You know, and the sister said, I don't think childhood has any effect on us.
Ouch.
So she felt absolutely put down. The sister was a very intelligent and successful woman. And so was she. And she felt terribly put down. And I said, okay, you got to try another strategy because psychological conversation ain't what she wants to do with you.
Yeah.
Well, and so she tried a bunch of stuff. And eventually what worked was astonishing. It was their children. Their children really liked each other. And one time after my friend made many, many attempts, which were not getting the kind of response she wanted, her son got a Valentine from all of his cousins.
Hmm.
That broke the ice.
Yeah.
Okay. And then about 6 months later, I said, well, what's going on? Did it ever get better? She said, we're just about to go on a vacation with the two families. And I almost fell off my chair.
Wow. That's awesome.
She said, that was the opening. And I now recognize, you know, that she's not a talker, but she's a doer.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is you just keep trying new things. But I'm curious, let's say, not in that situation, but another situation, the parents are still alive and that now they have adult siblings. Do you feel the parents should do anything to help make peace between siblings if the parents are still alive?
I don't think they can do a lot. I think all they can say is very often parents, even on their deathbeds, ask the siblings to get along.
Mm-hmm.
They can say, you know, it would be a good idea. I think it would be worthwhile for the two of you to try to talk. They can try to understand how they might have contributed and communicate that to the siblings. But when you're an adult, your parents aren't the ones who make you fix something. You do it.
Okay.
So I don't believe that there's a very great role for parents, although parents call me all the time and say, oh, my God, my two daughters, that we're about to have a family reunion and they can't stand each other and they're not talking. What do I do? Usually this is the 11th hour and the reunion is the next week, you know. But it's not a simple thing for the parents to fix. By the way, just to a point that you made before about you keep trying, you don't keep trying indefinitely. This woman was getting some positive feedback there. If the person says to you, I'm not interested, you are a nasty person, I don't want you in my life, and they keep saying this, you don't beat a dead horse forever.
Okay.
Don't.
Okay.
There are sibling relationships that are not fixable, and it is masochistic to continue to try to fix them. And you know one when you feel one, when you're in it. Hmm. One person I talked to said, I can't have a relationship with an active volcano. Her sister, every time she tried to approach her, did things like break her windshield or start screaming or, you know, really things like that. And she felt like after a bunch of tries, that was enough. Sometimes, by the way, one of the things that brings siblings together is illness. Okay. I've talked to a number of adult siblings where when they found out that their estranged brother or sister was sick, they wrote to them. One thing you can do in that situation, which often happens, is you can make a behavioral gesture, which is to say, can I help? Can I get your house clean? Can I take your kids someplace? Can I take you to the doctor? Can I go with you? That can go very far. I've seen it.
It's something about vulnerability, like, oh, they're vulnerable now.
Yeah. You know,
I found that when I had an AVM, that all my siblings were really helpful. So it just changes. Yeah, it's changing.
It's very moving when those things happen. Now, I was in a situation where I really, at the end of my brother's life, he's deceased and has been for a number of years. At the end of his life, I really made efforts, and he told me the only, you know, that I should give him money. And I said to him, the only thing, I wrote him a letter. I said, the only thing I cannot offer you is money. First of all, because I'm not his ATM. And second of all, because my mother was ill and it was really going for her. And I never heard from him again. So it's not always possible, and we shouldn't give the impression that every relationship is fixable. But a lot of them can be.
Dr. Jeannie Safer is a New York psychologist and author of Kane's Legacy and other books. You can hear our entire interview with her and find links to her work at our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. More with our other guests ahead as we continue our program on understanding and reducing sibling rivalry when Peace Talks Radio continues right after this break. Today on Peace Talks Radio, we're trying to understand sibling rivalry and ask questions of our guests about how to handle it, maybe even reduce it. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. Suzanne Kreider is doing our interviews today, and we head back now to more of her conversation with Atlanta authors and parents Deneen Milner and Nick Childs. They have two daughters together and an older son from Nick's previous marriage.
Deneen, you said when the second girl was born, the first daughter was really loving, and then over time, she became more competitive. So talk a little bit more about how that changed and why you believe it changed and what you did when you started to see the sibling rivalry.
Sure. I think that the reason why the dynamic changed was because when Lila was born, Mari was 3 years old, and so she's still a baby herself, really. And as a baby, you don't really sort of think too much about personality or differences or ways in that other people annoy you. She was 3 years old, and so all she knew was that there was a new baby, and boy, she sure smells good, and she's really cute and cuddly, and I get to help mommy change her diaper, and I get to hug her and smile for pictures. So that made sense. But the, like Nick, you know, has pointed out, it became an issue when Lila was able to express herself in a way that was, you know, with her voice, with her actions, with her personality. They are two totally different people.
She has a big personality.
Our little one has a huge personality. And my older daughter is, not to say that she doesn't have a big personality, she's just a more quiet personality. And so when her sister is loud and brash and in your face and, you know, boisterous and willing to stake her claim, that is, you know, the antithesis of who my older daughter is. And to have that around her 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year can be a lot. I think that we started recognizing this by the time Lila was about five or six, I'd say kindergarten, when Mari was in the third grade. And so she's at school and she knows which girls that she wants to be friends with and which ones she didn't want to be friends with. And now she comes home and the ones that she doesn't want to be friends with, that's her sister.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the conversation started rather early with the need to understand that your sister has the right to have that personality. It is who she is. And you have to let her be who she's going to be and figure out how to work your way around the parts that you don't necessarily care for and reach out for the parts that you do.
And we should add that, and we talk about this a lot, that we think that the older daughter admires the brashness or the largeness of her sister's personality. And I won't say that she's jealous, but I'm sure that she would say that you know, she maybe wouldn't mind having certain parts of that herself.
Mm-hmm. What does happen in our house that I'm quite proud of is that we talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when something does come up, your automatic inclination may be to lash out at it, but then I think in the back of your mind, you're remembering that conversation and understanding a little bit more where that other person is coming from and trying to respond in kind. And I have seen that happen between them even more so lately than before. And so, you know, I'm happy that we've chosen to parent in that kind of way, because, again, I didn't have that when I was growing up. And here I am looking at 47, and I'm just now getting to the point where I can actually have a halfway decent conversation with my brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when my daughters each turned 13, I asked 12 of my dear friends who are aunties to them and cousins to them to write them letters about womanhood and what it is that they should expect and how they should be in the world as young ladies becoming women. And for my younger daughter, who just turned 13 in early June, one of those letters I insisted needed to come from her older sister.
Mm.
And my older daughter just had the hardest time trying to figure out what to write. And she really started on a sort of, I don't want to say trite path, but it was just sort of impersonal is a good word. It was just very impersonal.
Superficial.
Right. And so she asked me what I thought about it, and I read it. And then we sat and we talked, which is, again, the theme of this entire conversation. You have to sit and talk to your children. And when we talked, I told her that she really needed to understand who her little sister is to her and who she is to her little sister, more importantly. And one of the biggest things that seemed to be a revelation to her was that her sister looks up to her and really admires her. And, you know, when she is thinking about what she's going to do on a test, or when she's trying to forge relationships, or when she's trying to just be, that she really looks to her older sister as an example of someone that she wants to be like. And just knowing that just sort of opened this floodgate of emotion for my older daughter to be able to write one of the most beautiful letters of the bunch to my little girl. And it just did my heart proud. It really was just a beautiful meditation on them being the only two in this situation, born of the same parents and in this life together under the same roof, you know, being raised by the hand of these two people. And so we have a very unique perspective on how to be, just because we are in this unique situation together.
Nick Childs and Denine Milner, authors, journalists, and parents from Atlanta, Georgia. Now more of Suzanne Kreider's talk with psychologist Samuel Roll in his Albuquerque office.
How about if the parents are not really good at role modeling? So what should the kids do then? If they're not learning how to be non-punitive, what do the kids do?
Well, I think you're gonna think I practice as a cleric. That's in the Bible too. When it says in the Bible, the sins of the father are visited on the children for three generations, that means that's what happens. If you have angry, hostile parents and they get a divorce and they destroy each other during the children learn that. And they increase the probability. But no, that doesn't make it certain. It increases the probability because, as a playwright pointed out, the sins of the father are visited on the children, but the children don't have to play host. And we have other models. We have teachers who don't yell at us when we do bad stuff, but instruct us instead. We have teachers who say, we have to work this out. We have teachers who say, we're going to have to find some way to take turns because we only have three computers and we have 12 children. How are we going to do that? So we not only rely, but the parents are the primary factors. If you have parents who show that what you do most easily and quickly with hostility, with frustration, is you turn it to anger, directed aggression against the other person, the child's going to be tempted to do that too. But not, there's always hope. You don't have to come out like your mom and dad, but that's the most likely outcome. But I think all of education, including the education we do here in psychotherapy, is to make sure that the person doesn't have to come out like their mom and dad or have to repeat the same pattern. The repeating the same patterns in psychoanalysis is called the repetition compulsion, the tendency to repeat, like in Groundhog Day. You always go back to where the mistake was made. Or Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, from the Sherlock Holmes stories, said before Freud, the criminal always returns to the scene of the crime. And Freud said, we all return to the scene of the crime. But we try to master what we do. So a little girl, her teacher might treat her mean in school. And when she comes home, what she often wants to do is take her doll and play school. But she's going back to the scene of the crime. Why would she go back to playing school where it was so painful? Because she's trying for a different outcome. She wants to master it. Because we have this tendency built in also for mastery. So when she is the teacher to the girl, she can have it come out some different way.
Sam, what if you're the younger sibling? Let's say you're 5 and I'm 10. So should you get a handicap if we're playing a game?
Well, that's for the children to work out, because if you don't get a handicap, then the game is less interesting. If you do get a handicap, then it's more interesting, but they have to work that out themselves. Because the older child wants to play the game and the younger child wants to play the game, and they both want it interesting. If one person has all the advantage, it's not going to be an interesting game. So as an adult, if you impose the handicap, you are going to increase the likelihood that they're going to fight.
Okay, so we have to work it out. But what if I just hit you over the head and say, look, I'm going to win this game? I mean, well, because I'm older, I'm smarter.
Then the game is over. I go to my room and I cry and you don't have anyone to play with.
Okay.
Well, Oscar Wilde talked about the tyranny of the weak over the strong. The weak are not totally without power. what Gandhi and Thoreau and Martin Luther King taught is that you can use the tyranny of the weak, of the strong, in very productive ways. But if you're in a game, and because of your superior knowledge, you're winning all the time, I say, well, I'm not going to play with you. The game is over. And the 10-year-old doesn't get to play. And you want it to play. Now, if you have a 10-year-old friend, you go play with your 10-year-old friend. But sometimes you just have your little brother. And that you want to play. There's so much in us that drives us toward each other. As Freud said, the only happiness we get in this godforsaken world is from our capacity to love, our capacity to be loved, and our capacity to be of use. And whatever else we've developed some tendencies to move toward those things. And so, you know, when we think, oh God, there has to be frustration, there has to be anger, there has to be anger, there has to be aggression, we also have to take the opposite into account. That we have a desire to be loved, and a desire to be loved, and a desire to be of use. And those are also powerful factors. And in from the psychoanalytic position, in peace training, that's what you train for. You train for maximizing that capacity to love. Because the more I love you, the less I'm willing to hurt you. The more I need your love and can accept your love, the less I'm willing to hurt you. The more I want to be of use in the world, the less I want to do damage in the world. So psychoanalytic education means focusing on these factors, knowing that we have strong inherent desires, sex and aggression, that get in the way. The rules, you know, a great peace teacher who had a few exceptions in his work once said, when the Pharisees said to Jesus, why did you heal this man on the Sabbath? First of all, you healed on the Sabbath, which means you're working on the Sabbath, and you also told him to pick up his pallet, which you're not supposed to carry stuff on the Sabbath. Jesus said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The monopoly rules were made for us, not us for the monopoly rules. If we want to play longer and we want to change the rules, we can do that. What benefits what we're doing? If I'm playing with my brother and it helps us play longer and be and love each other more, so what? I give him the handicap. What he learns is to accept my love. So the rules are made for us, not us for the rules.
If parents are concerned about their siblings and they come to you for therapy, I'm curious, like, would you say anything else about what you would tell them to make peace with siblings?
Well, first of all, I would tell them how they are likely getting in the way by now picking who's wrong and who's wrong. They're not wrong for fighting. Brothers fight. They're wrong for choosing sides. Their parents are wrong for choosing sides. But the children are wrong because you're disturbing me with all of that noise. I want you to go into your own rooms and come out, not in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, come out when you're ready not to fight. If they go in the room, stick one toe in the room and come out and not fight, you've got what you want. They're not fighting. They get punished for making noise. They get punished for breaking things. They get punished because there's hitting. You go to your rooms and come out when you can play without hitting. Therefore, you haven't chosen sides, even though you saw the 10-year-old hit the 5-year-old. And you know what? When you're a little guy, you have to learn to live in a world with big guys. There will always be someone with more power than you are. So that is a good lesson to learn. Everybody has a boss. Everybody's got somebody higher than them, right? How do you deal with people with more power than you without being sycophantic and without being oppositional and without being passive-aggressive? The very important lesson that the weaker learn about the stronger. Right?
Much more from Albuquerque psychologist Dr. Samuel Roll and more from all of our guests online at peacetalksradio.com. Details and sound files of all of our shows going back to 2002 are there, plus info on signing up for the free podcast, our monthly newsletter, or ordering CDs. Also learn how your tax-deductible contribution or used vehicle donation can help keep this program going. That's at peacetalksradio.com. Our executive director is Nola Daves Moses, theme music by Ali Adelman, support from KUNM and the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico. For Suzanne Kreider, I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.